is. I mean, what you've added about SC-42 is worth having on tape, and there'll be other ones. So, you're in Kanagami. Is there anything else after SC-42 of note that you want to talk about in Kanagami?
I don't really think so, no. Anything after SC-42 was kind of anticlimactic.
You saw other sinkings?
Almost none. Yeah. Almost none. Just lucky, I guess, the rest of the time.
Was Cowboy Jackson still in her when you left?
As I recall it, yes. Yeah. Dave Morton was in her by then. He joined.
But he, the same captain?
I think so. It's hard to remember.
Well,
the
Navy lists are there.
Yeah.
If you can't remember, then we've got nothing to put on tape. After Kanagami?
Well, then, of course, I joined you at King's.
And we did the short end.
Short end course.
This, what year was this? This was getting into 42.
42.
You passed the short end with distinction. Anything about the short end? I see Ben Siverts in the Union Club.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
I've always remembered that about the short end. The thing I remember most is what a good instructor Ben Siverts was.
Yes.
Excellent.
I'll tell him that.
Next time I see him. I really would. Excellent.
This is the time to tell you how highly Ted Briggs thought of you, by the way. Mm. It is. I was in hospital with him years ago. He was getting a new knee. I just had a broken bone.
Yeah.
And he talked a lot about you.
Did he?
Oh, he did.
We became very good friends.
Yeah.
Very good friends.
All right, the short end. It's hard to cut it down, isn't it?
Yes. The short end. No, my chief memory of the short end was that I was working hard all day on that and playing pretty hard, courting Margot at night.
Yeah, well...
Didn't get too much sleep.
I spent more time with Alma than I did with my books.
Which was important.
But at last, this is a signal that we're starting to do something about training. We're taking RCNVRs in 1942 and teaching them Astro.
Yes. And you recall that if you were over 26, it was a command course rather than a... exactly the same course.
Because Ted Simmons and Evans and the others went to commands.
Yes, that's right.
They didn't go to commands, but they got commands, shortly after.
Yeah. That's right. We had a minimum of naval law and supply and stuff like that, a maximum of operational.
Goldby was on that course. He used to tell some fantastic stories.
I've seen Tom since, I think.
He was adrift in France one night. On his way back from whenever he was supposed to blow up, he knew this was a German officer's whorehouse. And he stopped in and he put the girls off to one side and shot the clients and carried on and was picked up.
God.
And the Frenchman approved. That was very good discrimination. Goldby.
Ronnie Wayman.
Ronnie is the CBC director of many successful TV plays.
I can't remember whether Ian Bell was on that course.
He was.
Yes.
The two Chenoweths.
Both Chenoweths, that's right. In fact, is there not a photograph of it in King's?
There's a photograph of it in the navigation school in Stadacona here, if you want to see yourself.
Is there? Is there?
The nav school, yeah.
It seems to me I had a copy, but I can't find it.
Yeah. And you went from there to where?
From there I went to the Wetaskiwin with Guy Hugh Windeer, and that was another experience.
Talk about Windeer for a moment. Wasn't he retired RN?
He was a retired RN officer, and I wouldn't like to say anything that might be injurious to his darling wife.
No, well,
anything like that.
Nothing that you... But, well, you won't say it, but if you happen to, it wouldn't be released by Alec Douglas anyway.
I'll
never repeat anything injurious. I repeat to people within the Band of Brothers things of interest, which the narrator would have told them anyway had he been in the room, but I never repeat anything injurious.
In fact, Windy was retired somewhat precipitately from the, as I understand, I was told at the time, from the, not by him, from the Royal Navy as a sub-lieutenant, because a faithful Chinese fisherman on the China station turned up one day with a net full of CBs, for which Windy had signed the destruction certificate. Mm. And he hadn't burnt them exactly.
No.
And he then came to I guess he came straight to Canada. He was an Irishman. Came straight to Canada and went into fruit farming, which was a dicey business indeed. And I think he and his wife went through many hard times. Where were they? Vernon or Duncan? Vernon, I guess. On the mainland, anyway.
On the Okanagan Valley, yeah.
And he was a very excitable man, too. I seem to have a lot of excitable captains during the war.
Is that why he was called Windy?
No, that's just his name was Windier. Yeah. Yeah. Wind Dyer. But he was holder of the black belt of judo.
Did he practice it in the wardroom?
The only... No, I'm not going to say any more about this.
All right.
No, he didn't. He practiced it elsewhere. an interesting man, but you had to know your place with Windy. One moment he'd have his arm around you saying, great work, Dan, and the next minute he'd be saying, stand to attention when you speak to the captain.
Oh, well, that's terrible.
So that takes somebody with a rather non-worrying nature, I guess, like myself, to really get along very well with him.
Yeah.
Of course, Freddie Frew was his first lieutenant in Sally.
Yeah.
ONS 154.
Yeah.
And eventually he had to be relieved of his duties and sedated.
Yes. I'll get that from Freddie in due course.
Yes. We compared some other interesting notes on Windy over the last couple of days.
So you're in what with Windy?
No, the Wetaskiwin.
Wetaskiwin, yes.
Dickie Lester was the first lieutenant.
Oh, no.
When I joined West Coaster.
Yeah. Now, what did Wetaskiwin do?
Well, Wetaskiwin did exactly the same thing as Okanagan had been doing, except rather better, because she had much longer sort of worked up by the time I got there.
Yeah.
Our most notable effort, I guess, was cooperating with Skeena and sinking the U-boat. It was my second interesting action of the war.
Well, tell me that one. Is that where you got your DSC?
Yes, it is.
Yeah,
yes, so. It is. And that was simply because I found it when all else had lost it.
Well, describe it from the beginning.
By this time, the destroyers and some of the ships in the convoy had HFDF, and consequently they were unable to listen to reporting submarines, which were usually hoovering around somewhere on the port quarters or somewhere like that, reporting, of course, the speed of the convoy. And she had gone out and found this submarine on an HFDF there. This is written up. This is written up in Milner's book, much better than I can do it. And
well, then you've read it. Anything that Milner's missed, but go on chronologically.
And I think the thing was that he was a pretty good U-boat captain, this man. And with the range of ASDIC on that day, which was a minute number of yards, about 800 yards, I think, if I remember, was sort of the best that we got, he was dodging violently down there. And Skeena had expended, you can check this with Morris Chadwick, who was the AS officer in Skeena, but I think she'd expended all but her last five depth charges. In fact, he expended his last five depth charges on her when he sank her, if I remember.
Who found her?
Skeena found her initially, and we were summoned to help. And that's exactly what we were doing. I was using the Gladstone plot again, you know. Mm-hmm. And finally, she'd sort of disappeared in the heat of the action, and I was able to locate her to predict where she would be found again from the plot.
Your plot, isn't
from
that
the plot,
good?
Which really worked that time.
Yeah.
And that's why I got the DSC.
Well, well-deserved, too. Yeah, that was responsible for sinking that U-boat, then.
Well, in fact, Chad had his depth right on the depth charges, too, you know.
She would have got away if you hadn't predicted where to look.
I think she might have.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I certainly wasn't averse to having people think that.
No. One ship standing off and one ship attacking?
Yes, I think, as I recall, Skeena did more attacking than we did, mm-hmm. Because she had so much better equipment.
Mm. Well. We still haven't got a head-throwing mm-hmm. weapons?
Nope, not in that stage of the game.
So there's so much turbulence in the water.
That's right, yes.
You hunted her for how long?
I really don't remember. I couldn't note the passing of time at the time. You know,
more than 1 hour.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I think it was over several hours.
Yeah.
But there again, Milner, I think, says.
Well, Milner knows.
But I remember...
And she came to the surface?
No.
I've forgotten.
She just disappeared. There was a big explosion down there, and all pieces of things floated up, including pieces of people.
Yeah.
And our bit of evidence was the best part of a human chest, which was picked up in a tin can. Well, put in a tin can and put in the fridge. And they were serving pork that night, and not much of it got eaten. Those are the sort of things you remember, isn't it odd?
Isn't it? Oh, well, it's probably not odd.
Yeah, that signal, that action was noted by a rather good exchange of signals between Skeena and Wetaskiwin, which are also recorded.
Joe Shull used them.
And, yes, that's right. The beast arose from the deep having...
Horned head.
Having seven heads... Seven horned heads, and upon the head seven crowns, and upon its brow the name of infamy.
Yeah.
If I remember.
Very good. Very
so,
good.
So words to that effect. Let me see. What did happen then? That seemed to last a long time, too. And it lasted until we went into refit in Galveston, Texas, at the Todd Shipyards.
Todd, T-O-D-D?
Yes. Which was on an island of Galveston Harbor. One half of the island was occupied by the shipyard, the other half was occupied by rattlesnakes, which made it interesting.
Yeah.
And the ship, of course, when we got in there, the ship was completely denuded of crew, but we had to keep a watch on board. And they stripped her. Everything stripped out of her. The only heating left was one heater in the wardroom, an electric heater. And a duty watch on that ship was an absolute misery. The day we got into Galveston, there was ice on the puddles,
right.
And it was cold, quite cold. Margot came down and joined me there because we got the munificent sum of $5 a day for lodge and scrounge. So she came down for Christmas, bearing in her suitcase, or her trunk, she brought a trunk with her, a small but perfect Christmas tree. And we lived in the home of some delightful old ladies down there, very, very ancient, one of whom had been a ballet instructor, both of whom were determinedly Southern in their attitudes. For instance, one of them said to me one day, "You know, Lieutenant, I don't think it's right. The only thing you ever hear in this war is how the Yankees done this and the Yankees done that," which was absolutely true. Down there, the Pacific War was the big thing. Nobody heard of the Atlantic, so I said, "Well, Miss Vida, isn't that nice to hear you say that?"
What's her name?
Miss Vida.
D-I-D-A. D-A, yeah.
Miss Vida. Isn't it nice to hear somebody say that? Exactly what do you mean? And he said, "Yeah, you know, Lieutenants, us Southerners is in this too."
Yeah.
And that was a pretty typical attitude. They had a great party for all us people in Oakville and Wetaskiwin when they arrived there. A lot of pretty girls.
Did you mention Oakville?
Yes.
Was she there?
Bill Evans was Oakville, wasn't he?
Yeah. Well, was she there too?
Yes.
Oh.
We were doing our refits together. Had a party with all these pretty marriageable young girls who absolutely... The first question they asked was, "Are you married?" And the second thing they did was never speak to you again if you were.
Yeah, well, sure.
It made it pretty clear what they were looking for.
Yeah.
Eligible husbands. And,
I think they were lied to, perhaps.
Perhaps. Not by me,
because
my
you.
Wife was arriving in 3 days' time.
Yeah, you and Margot had married by this time.
We married in 43, yes.
Yeah. What year are we up to anyway now that you're doing your refit?
End of 43.
Wetaskiwin in the end of 43. So we're going into 44, and what happened in that year?
Well, I was drafted off Wetaskiwin after about 6 weeks down there to join the New Waterford with Teddy Briggs. That's how I got to that ship.
Would you like to talk about Ted for a while? I know you're fond of him, and
I'm
he's
very,
fond of you.
I'm very fond of him. He was a remarkable fellow in many ways. You know, he was the radio commentator who kept the program going for 2 hours when the King and Queen's train was late in 1939, describing the magnificent works of art in the Nova Scotian ballroom. There wasn't a painting on the wall. So he was an ad libber, which was a good thing in many ways.
I remember that broadcast. He knew a lot about the royal family anyway, and he all sorts of little interesting anecdotes about royalty in general. That's still a masterpiece in Canadian radio. You know how Ted Briggs didn't let people feel that everything had gone wrong.
That's right. No, it was an expert. Well, and he did a lot of that in the ship, too. And it was a very...
That's the quality of the captain that's never mentioned in the leadership schools.
That's right, yeah. But as you recall, the best direction officers at the beginning of air direction were actors, because they could ad-lib, and they could make the pilots feel they were taken care of even when they weren't.
Yeah.
And it's an invaluable talent to have, and Ted had it before. Yes, that was an interesting ship. The first lieutenant, when she arrived, or when I arrived, was a remarkable gentleman by the name of Ruddle Brown.
Yeah.
And then our lieutenant, I guess, whose qualifications were that he was a rat catcher or a rodent operative.
He was.
Profession. And he was, poor man, was absolutely hopeless as a first lieutenant. He was paranoid.
Well, he was hopeless as a navigator in Moose Jaw.
Was he?
Ruddle Brown... The word alcoholic is thrown around loosely these days. Ruddle Brown wasn't an alcoholic, but whiskey was just part of his day's routine. And I was in charge of the wardroom wine, and he said, why don't we come to an agreement? He said, I'd like a drink sometimes when there's nobody around to sign a chip for. I'll put a bottle in my cabin, and I'll keep the empties in a sock, and you count the empties at the end of the month and charge me. So, Brownie was a bit hazy a lot of the day, but not a drunk, but a drinker.
Well, unfortunately, by the time he got to be... When Teddy had asked for him, for some reason, to be XO...
Pardon?
Teddy had asked for Brownie to be XO for some reason I never could understand.
He served with Ralph Hennessy as a mate. I think he was a mate.
Mate, huh?
In a Cinnabon when they were knocked about by U-210.
Anyway, he
they
was,
must have served together in the merchant service, something like that.
I don't think Teddy had ever did any time in the merchant service. He passed his third mate's ticket, as far as I know, and that was the end of it. Well, he went straight into artistic things thereafter.
Well, anyway, he asked for Ronald Brown, who was not an organizer. No, I
not only was he not an organizer, but he was dictatorial, and he didn't know how to punish and reward. He could punish, but he couldn't reward. And he had the wardroom in that ship in an absolute state of chaos. I forget whether Dick Galpin was there at the time.
G-A-L-P-I-N?
Yeah, the kilted doctor last night.
Oh, yeah.
From Hunter.
Yes.
CEO of Hunter, ex-CEO of Hunter. But Dick... anyway, Ruddle Brown got so paranoid that he used to get into the engineer's cabin just behind the wardroom, at the end of the wardroom. And stick his ear to the bulkhead to hear what the wardroom officers were saying about him. And finally, Teddy got me aside on the jetty one day and asked me what I thought of him. And it was the first time I'd opened my mouth, of course. And so I had to tell him. And, he was relieved.
Sorry, I forgot what corvette we're in.
We're in the new frigate, the New Waterford.
New Waterford.
This time. Now, New Waterford had been supposed to join EG-6 for the invasion. Mm-hmm. But she cracked an engine cone on her way around, I think, from the West Coast. Mm-hmm. And that had to be replaced, and we missed D-Day by 2 weeks, or thereabouts. And they sent us over there, and we operated a few cross-channel convoys, cross-channel patrols, and then as a support group, you know, on the wings. We did some time in the channel, actually, looking for E-boats.
Joe Clark. J.A.P. Clark was with you, wasn't he? He was in New Waterford with Briggs.
He must have been. Why don't I remember him?
I don't know.
Not all.
He was downstairs last night, not downstairs, in the Scotian
School. Roger Sweeney was there, Dick Fladgate. Bill Mitchell was the first lieutenant after Ruddle Brown. Art Crockett, who became president of Bank of Nova Scotia.
They're in the Navy. He probably was there after you.
So
talk about New Waterford. You've talked about the patrols.
Well, the
Didn't you take part in a submarine?
Yes, we did in the Rose Garden.
U-1006.
Annan.
Annan and New Waterford.
Well, New Waterford was the SO, but we didn't actually have a part in the sinking of that
ship. No, you didn't, but you came back and picked up survivors.
Yes, we did. That's right.
And Joe Clark, when you see him again, met the captain of the U-1003, who was with the U-1006, in the Royal York Hotel in Toronto, when they invited all the ex-U-boat officers of the area in for dinner, and he was sitting alongside him, and Joe was telling him about picking up survivors from the U-1006, and the fellow said, yes, I know, I had you in my sights. I fired two torpedoes. And Joe said, well, you must have missed. And the captain of U-103 said, well, we had bad pistols, but we had you in our sights, and we fired two fish at you, and the conversation went on from there. Yes.
Go on.
Yeah.
Well, we had, that was the fight where Davy Howitt lost his kidney. He was the officer of the quarters, gunnery officer.
How did he lose his kidney?
20-millimeter shrapnel.
Yeah. From
the 1006, whatever it was. And so he wrote a little story, actually, in Trident last year about this.
Which your daughter is editing.
Right.
And you're working for her.
I'm working for her.
Her name is?
Felicity.
Felicity.
Here's
Felicity Hannington into naval history.
Right. And, of course, the Trident is owned by her brother, Brian Hannington.
Yeah.
And my pay for working like a dog for her is to be taken to dinner once a quarter.
Well, sure. Good businesswoman.
Yeah, oh yes. So
that's 1006.
Right. The exciting thing I remember about my time in New Waterford, though, was nothing to do with action. It was going into Scapa Flow through the South Gate the very first time, by blind pilotage with 271 radar, in the middle of a blinding rainstorm. I think I lost more sleep over that entry than I ever did over anything else in the ship.
But without it, you couldn't have gone in.
That's right.
And that's back to the equipment.
You
have the equipment, you can...
Once we were fitted with 271, we had two radar techs, whatever we called them in those days. It made all the difference in the world. It was a very good set, that 10-centimeter set.
So the war's 4 years old, somehow or other we've got trained, we've got the equipment, and we're starting to perform.
Right.
The RCN is.
Right.
Yeah.
Whereas the destroyers had sort of come to a lot before our escort.
For the same reason, they didn't have the same...
They didn't have quite such a bad drain on their manpower.
Manpower, and
they got better equipment.
Got better equipment.
Even at that, they got it very slowly. Mm-hmm. Most of the RN escort destroyers were fitted with HFDS long before our ships got it. And that was invaluable. I don't know, it's very hard to compress 5 years.
Any others? Well, we're getting up to, we're in 44, so we're getting there. Any other sinkings or heavy attacks?
Well, no, not heavy attacks. No, by this time, somehow or other, of course, the U-boat war had ground down in the Atlantic. Most of my time then in the ship was spent running around the British Isles. Attacking every non-sub contact in the place. Yeah. We carried out one very successful attack on a Fern contact. By this, we had Hedgehog. We hit it, and millions upon millions of French letters floated to the surface. A sea of condoms. Which, of course, were no good to anybody by this time. We certainly weren't going to stop and pick them up.
It's rather interesting to speculate which way the ship was bound that was carrying them as cargo.
I was also there when, oh my goodness, was it Team or Cam? Had her stern
it was
blown
team.
Off. Team. We were right alongside her, about, you know, sort of 500 yards away doing a square search.
Yeah.
When she was hit.
Acoustic torpedo.
Alma,
that's T-E-M-E.
She said the other day that she'd been lost. She wasn't. She was towed into Falmouth, I think, if I recall.
She was into Falmouth. Joe Clark told me.
Then I was also there when Cam, it must have been Cam then.
How do you spell that?
C-A-M.
Yeah.
Did a hedgehog attack on what turned out to be a sunken ammunition ship, which blew up underneath her. And Dick Galpin can confirm this.
E-L-P-I-N? Galpin?
Galpin.
G-A-L-P-I-N.
Mm-hmm.
Blew up underneath him?
You could see the shoreline, the entire length of that ship underneath the keel. She went straight out of the water. And every man on board was injured. The captain, the first lieutenant, had something like 27 intestinal perforations. They kept him alive and got him into Hasler, and he lived. And Dick said to me at the time, if I'd known what he was like inside, I wouldn't have bothered. I think there were 143 compound fractures of the legs. Anybody who was standing up, of course, broke his ankles as soon as he came down again. At least one man was killed by falling depth charges.
By what?
Falling depth charges.
Fell on top of them.
It just was the most ghastly looking.
Never heard of that.
Affair.
Extraordinary.
She was an RN ship, I think.
Yeah.
But, you know, it didn't make any difference in those days. Sometimes I get a little irritated with everybody trying to draw a distinction between naval actions between the RN and the RCN in those days. We were completely melded. Mm-hmm. You went where you were required, and that, to me, is the right way to fight a war.
And you fitted in, too.
Oh, yes, because...
Same procedures,
same equipment, virtually. So there was no problem about that at all. It was much more difficult working with the Americans.
What else in New Waterford?
Well, I don't really recall any other specific events. Being alongside in Chatham and watching the buzz bombs go overhead on their way to London, the typhoons knocking them out of the sky with armored wingtips.
Yeah, they just tipped the wing up.
Tipped the wing up and she went down into Romney Marsh.
I see that. I've seen that. Yeah.
Navigation in the channel, of course, was appallingly difficult before we got DECA, which was then known as QM, remember?
Yeah.
The minesweepers were fitted with it so they could sweep the mm-hmm. approaches to the beaches. Then us escort ships got it too. Because we used to run back and forth. The senior officer of the group, after we first joined, we'd run back and forth across the channel. By the time we got to the other side, which was probably 25 or 30 miles, I might be 10 miles from where I thought I was because of the extraordinarily difficult currents one was faced with. And once we got DECA, it was fine. But that was another equipment thing, Loran and DECA.
There was almost a fighter direction type of organization, too, where you were steered in by a shore station.
Yes, there was, and this was very good. It was run by Wrens.
Yes.
Most of whom had very pretty voices.
Yes.
And it sounded sort of incongruous, vector 230, you know, sort of thing, coming out of these little girls who were sitting somewhere on the top of the Isle of Wight with a radar station up there. There was another one in Cornwall, and I can remember once excited little Wren saying, "You're in a minefield! You're in a minefield!" Well, we were always in the minefield. We used to go and sit in the deep minefield because we could hang around there being quiet and know that the submarines were most unlikely to come into it. And we could listen and so forth and get ready for our next job. We eventually got censured by the Admiralty, or CNC Western Approaches, I guess, for this practice and had to stop it. But I can remember one little Wren made a mistake. Vectored us after ourselves. She had made a bearing error, I guess, and she thought that we were a group of E-boats 30 miles up channel from where we actually were. We chased after ourselves for quite a long time before they sorted that one out. But it was a great help, I must say, to have those girls doing that.
Isn't it terrible to think that it took us 4 years to get effective, though?
Yes. Yes, it was a long time, But by that time, we could hold our heads up with anybody.
Yeah.
Which was great.
Yeah.
That's at that sort of time that the gun shield graffiti disappeared again.
Yeah, didn't need to.
We didn't need it, and B, they'd put rocket rails, if you recall, on the side of the gun shield, so there wasn't anywhere to put it.
It's in that book.
Yes. Mm. So that was practically the end of the war for me. We got back to Halifax just before VE Day. And Bob Turnbull and Rosemary Wallace, my wife's sister, was not then married. She was now Rosemary McDonald.
Junior's wife, yeah.
And Margot and I were across at Herring Cove, I think it was Herring Cove, just across the arm from in the park having a picnic when they heard the news that everybody was recalled on VE Day afternoon. So we got back on the ferry, and then we had to walk back to the dockyard. And I remember on the way, a sailor carrying a case of beer stopped us on the North Common and come out of the Owens Brewery out there and very generously offered it to us. He said there was lots more where that came from.
Yeah.
We went back to the ships, and I think there were 23 ships in harbor, and we only had 26 absentees.
That's good.
It was not the ships. They stayed strictly aloof from that.
I was in Montreal when that happened and came back immediately, and the first thing I asked, when I was number one of Sioux, and I asked, any trouble? He said, not with our troops, sir. He said,